Victor Hugo called it the soul of the ship. Along with the astrolabe and the sextant, the compass allowed mariners to sail beyond the sight of land and open new worlds to commerce and exploration. The evolution of this instrument absorbed many of the finest minds of the past millennium who struggled with the mysteries of magnetism and mathematics, and it's a story littered with disaster, shipwrecks, and death. If you have questions about the development of this vital instrument, why, for example, does the fleur-de-lis always mark north? Or if you've had adventures good or bad with the compass, give us a call. Our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. And joining us now from the BBC's Broadcasting House in London is Alan Gurney, author of the newly published book, Compass, A Story of Evolution and Innovation. And thanks very much for joining us today on Talk of the Nation. Welcome.
Good afternoon.
The compass is an instrument that those of us now in the 21st century take completely for granted. You tell a story in the introduction to your book that illustrates just how lost we can be without it.
Yeah, I suppose you're referring to the sort of super high-tech yacht with an inductor compass, or what is known as a fluxgate compass, which works off electricity. And it sort of set off sailing, and it had didn't have any charts on board. It was all, you know, this sort of super high-tech thing, and all electrical systems failed due to a switchboard failure. And so suddenly there was this yacht, brand new, sailing out in the middle of the ocean in the dark, and they were reduced to what the sailors used to have to do in the old days and just rely upon the wind.
And luckily for them, the wind was blowing in the same direction.
Exactly right, and it stayed in the right direction. They managed to make their way back to the marina, you know, after a day or so. And it was that story which sort of led me to think, well, there's a thing about this compass, because, you know, in my early life, before I became a writer, I was a yacht designer. And, in fact, coming up today on the train to London, I was thinking, why did I write this book? And suddenly I realized it all came down to a question of toilet paper. Now, I'm not going to get scatological now about toilet paper, but all you Americans have this sort of soft tissue toilet paper. We have it over here too nowadays. But when I was young, it was rather like greaseproof paper, you know, with the absorbent qualities of. And as a small boy, I used to sort of sit in the bath, and this is my beginning of my naval architecture, and make little paper boats out of the British-type toilet paper. And they all sort of floated for, well, anyway, a few minutes. Now, I'm convinced that if I'd sort of been an American and had soft tissue toilet paper, my ideas of being a naval architect would have literally sunk on the spot or foundered. And also there's another one about the compass which is still green in my memory. And again, we're now going back in the 1950s, because I'm very ancient, you see. And everybody was working with things which sort of hang over from the Second World War, and this, they had a thing called a radio direction finder, or a beamy loop. And you'd be sailing along there, and I was a helmsman, and I was sort of kind of brand new to all this sailing. And you'd get this voice coming down from down below, and the beamy loop work on radio direction, there's a whole bunch of light vessels stuck around the North Sea. And they came on, and they gave a Morse code on a sort of sequence. And so the navigator was trying to fix on this thing, and the beamy loop literally was a loop, and he sort of swerved it round, and you reached a point where you couldn't hear anything, and that was the null. And there was a compass rose on this sort of magic machine, and he would yell up to you, mark, and you'd have to say what you were steering at that precise time. And he'd maybe take three or four bearings and hope to get a position. And, of course, if the cocked hat of this position was a big wide one, it was your fault as a helmsman. And if it was a good one, you know, it's just because he was a brilliant navigator and had good ears.
Your story is also the story of some of the great geniuses and a couple of frauds thrown in who populate this story. Edmund Halley, Francis Beaufort, one of the great heroes. Lord Kelvin plays a part in all of this. But there's one particular man whose story is a little short of astonishing, and that's Matthew Flinders. Tell us a little bit about Matthew Flinders.
Yeah, well, you know, Matthew sort of Flinders appeared in one of my previous books, and he's one of my great favorites. Because he was a young man who went to sea, much against his family's advice, and ended up in Australia doing survey work. And he suddenly found out that, he was in the Royal Navy, that when you took a bearing on the headland, and even though the ship never sort of changed position, just swung round, the bearing would change, and this sort of intrigued him. And he decided that he'd try to investigate this. Having spent a few years in Australia, called New Holland in those days, and came back, and he wrote a letter to Sir Matthew, Sir James Banks, who was one of the great men of England at the moment.
Cook's great sailing partner, yes.
Yes, exactly, yeah, sail on the Endeavour, now a lot older. But he chose the right man to write to. What he wanted, and this is extraordinary for Matthew Flinders, he's no more than a young lieutenant with sort of no experience, and he just said, look, I wanted to survey the whole coast of New South Wales or New Holland, and I think I'm capable of doing it, etc., etc. So Banks received this letter, and there's a big pause, and nothing happened, and poor old Flinders thought, you know, he'd really shot his bolt. But then he did get a reply, and he went to see Banks, and Banks says, right, okay, I think I can arrange it, which he did. And suddenly Flinders was in charge of a vessel called the Investigator, which is very similar to Cook's vessels, which are sort of North Sea colliers.
To make a very long story a great deal shorter, this was happening during the Napoleonic Wars, and Matthew Flinders found himself afoul of a Bonapartist, captured, thrown into a prison on the Isle of Mauritius, and in the process of being held for like 6 years, he worked out some important principles of mathematics.
Yeah, well, this is it. This is the extraordinary thing about Flinders. And he managed to send some papers to the Royal Society when he was in Mauritius being held by this governor, they're very important. And when he was released, he got back to the Admiralty, and the Admiralty said, okay, you can start doing some more investigations on the compass, which he did. And what he'd suggested, and which is now known as the Flinders Bar, in order to compensate for the strange things which he knew were happening to the compass, he organized a system of doing it, suggested the Flinders Bar, that this was the ideal compensation. But, of course, it was never taken up by the Admiralty, because the Admiralty sort of... And a lot of times they got all this advice and never did anything. And that seemed to be the whole history of the 19th century of the Admiralty.
Yeah, your book is replete with these episodes of this brilliant idea that vanishes into the black hole of
yes,
the Admiralty.
Yeah.
Now, let's get a caller into this conversation. Now, Mark joins us from Cape May, New Jersey.
Hi, Neil. You said something before, I think, at the start of this conversation about compasses pointing north.
Yes.
I've traveled a lot overseas. It's my understanding that the Chinese invented the compass. And I want you to know that over in Taiwan, when you buy a genuine Chinese compass, the red side of the needle points south. So be careful. Be careful. It doesn't always point north.
Okay. I'll accept that. Go ahead, Alan Gurney.
Right. Yeah. Well, they didn't invent the marine compass. They knew about magnetism in the late 11th century, but the first recorded evidence that they knew about the marine compass was, in fact, about the same time as we knew it over here, which was the 12th century. But they used it not for my book is really concerned with the marine compass. They used it for necromancy, and they knew about the magnetism. They did call it called it pointing south, which is an odd thing, but doesn't really matter because, let's face it, it aligns either north and south to the either poles.
And why is it that the fleur-de-lis always on western compasses indicates north?
It's one of these, nobody really knows it, but there's a theory that one of the names from the Mediterranean was Tramontana, which was the north wind coming from the mountains. And the T, if you invert it, it looks like a fleur-de-lis. Obviously, somebody decided to, sort of make it a little bit nicer and a bit more attractive. And that's the theory that's where it comes from. But it's always been there. It's one of those things, which I rather like. You know, it's one of those instant things you'd know about the compass, that there it is, that fleur-de-lis. But also, the early compasses also had a cross marking east, which shows the Christian.
Mark, thanks very much for the correction and for the call.
Great show, Neil.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Very quickly, from Michael Halley, if you're in the Southern Hemisphere, is the North Pole still the point with the strongest magnetic attraction?
Ah, right. Not really, because if you go in the southern hemisphere, you know, you're getting down, well, particularly if you're getting down below Australia, you're getting into the southern magnetic pole. But it aligns north and south, but you get this strange thing called dip. And so as soon as you get any close to either of the magnetic poles, you get vast variation, and the compass, the magnetic compass, becomes pretty wobbly.
And this is the story told in Compass, a story of exploration and innovation, the story of dip variation and all kinds of terrible problems worked out by bright people. Alan Gurney is the author. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News.